Christmas gifts over the past few decades. And I want you to raise your hand if you have either gotten this gift or given it. Now, some of you aren't even old enough to remember some of these, but I'd just be curious if you've gotten the must-have. Like in 1983, the must-have gift was a Cabbage Patch doll. Yeah, all right. That was a must-have. Okay, 1985, the must-have was a pound puppy. Yeah, two for two on some of you. 1989, a Game Boy. Must-have. Yeah, all right. You guys get everything. Okay, 1995, Beanie Baby. Wow, a lot. 1996, I think my favorite, Tickle Me Elmo. a new iPod, 2002. Mm-hmm, not as many. 2006, a Wii. Yep. Oh, you guys are spoiled. 2010, a Kindle. I got one of those. 2011, Angry Birds board game. It was a must-have gift. Nope. 2013, I don't know if I've heard of it. Doc McStuffins doll. Okay, I see moms rolling their eyes. 2015, last year, the must-have gift was the Frozen sing-along Elsa doll. Let it go. Would someone get that for me, please? I'd love to have it. Just kidding. And I don't know what is this year, but I think I saw, it might be the Hatchimals. Have you said? I think that might, I don't know. Anyway, all this month we're focusing on gifts, specifically God's gifts to us. And last week, Garrett did a fine job, a great job on the gift of hope. In the coming weeks, we're going to talk about the gift of joy and the gift of salvation, but none of them are possible without the best gift. God is a giving God. I want to start there. You know, Christmas is a gift-giving time, of course, and it reflects the kind of God that we have. In fact, I'm going to suggest God is the inventor of giving. And many parables in the Gospels present God as this irrepressible giver, even when the parable doesn't even have that as the point. Jesus talks, for instance, about a farmer who scattered seeds so liberally that most of it didn't take root. He threw some on the road. He threw some in the ditch where the weeds were. Some threw on rocky soil where it didn't have a chance. He was just throwing it everywhere, this extravagant farmer. Once there was a king who forgave a debt of 10,000 talents, would be about $10 million today. Whoever forgives a debt like that, that big? And then there's another king who gave wedding invitations to every undesirable person in the county. Everyone is welcome. A vineyard owner who gave people far more than where their work was worth. If you worked 1 hour, he would give you 8 hours pay. Way more than what was earned. Once there was a father who gave away a big part of his estate to a rebellious son, to a spoiled brat, basically, and gave him a big party when he came crawling back. There was a landowner who gave his vineyard over to his tenants. It's just hard to think of any parable in which the God figure is not giving away far more than he should. It's the same with the miracles. A wedding. Jesus turned water into wine. Really, Jesus? What wedding needs 150 gallons of fine wine? That's a lot. How about a lunch? Could he not count? I mean, he miraculously, you know, feeds the thousands, you know, with the bread and fish, and he had 12 leftover baskets. Surely he knew that was more than enough. It seems that everything bordered on the extravagant. Fishing. Who produces 153 fish out of nowhere, nearly causing the boat to sink? You go over to John and his teaching on the Holy Spirit, another of the amazing gifts. And, of course, we have the cross and the resurrection. You know, for God so loved the world that he gave his Son. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give himself as a ransom for many. And each of these texts, the gift is Jesus. Because all other gifts flow through him. So God is a giver. His best gift is Jesus. Thanks be to God, the Apostle Paul says, for this indescribable gift. Well, I'm going to spend a couple minutes trying to describe the indescribable. Luke 2, 1 through 7. Let's put that up on the screen. Okay, would you read that with me? This is familiar. Let's read it together. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be enrolled. This was the first enrollment when Quirinius was governor of Syria. And all went to be enrolled, each to his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the city of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem. because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be enrolled with Mary, his betrothed, who was with child. And while they were there, the time came for her to be delivered, and she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling cloths and laid him in a manger because there was no place for them. In the days of Caesar Augustus, Quirinius was the governor of Syria, and all the world shall be enrolled or taxed. And what Luke is saying, well, what is Luke saying with that introduction? He didn't have to give the historical background there. He puts it in the context, really, of global politics. Caesar Augustus was the president of the world. Everyone knew who Caesar Augustus was. And all the world was going to be enrolled. And so Luke is kind of subtly saying, Jesus is a universal gift. All the world. Over in Matthew, the genealogy of Jesus includes Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba. And which was odd about that, they were women, and women usually were not included in genealogies back then. And three of the four women were notorious sinners. But here's another thing. All four of those women were foreigners. Tamar, Rahab were Canaanites. Ruth was a Moabitess. Bathsheba was the wife of Uriah the Hittite, very likely Hittite herself. And the clear message in that is Jesus, this Jewish Messiah, had Gentile blood. He identified with every nation, the Moabites and the Canaanites and the Hittites. A global enterprise, a universal gift. Russ Blowers was a minister over at Indianapolis, and he was a member of his local Rotary. And each week, one Rotarian would get up and describe their profession. And here's what he said. He did not tell who he was or what his profession was. He said, I'm Russ Blowers. I'm with a global enterprise. We have branches in every country in the world. We're into motivational and behavioral alteration. We run hospitals, feeding stations, crisis pregnancy centers, publishing houses, universities. We care for our clients from birth until death. We specialize in life insurance and fire insurance. We perform spiritual heart transplants. Our original organizer owns all the real estate on Earth, plus an assortment of galaxies and constellations. He knows everything and he lives everywhere. Our product is free for the asking. Our CEO was born in a hick town, worked as a carpenter, didn't own a home, was misunderstood by his family, hated by his enemies, walked on water, was condemned to death without trial, and arose from the dead. I talk to him every day. A global enterprise, a universal gift that has impacted every aspect of reality. And one of the emphases at Christmas should be, and we usually don't think of this, but it should be missions. This should be an outreach month. In Christmas, God became a missionary. He sent his son into the world. And if we want to truly honor Christ at this time, we become missionaries. We are sent into the world to bring them to God, invite people to Christmas Eve, invite people to worship any Sunday, invite them to Connecting Spot or whatever. This gift is not to be held selfishly, but to be shared with all nations. Universal gift. Also a humble gift, obviously. God comes as a baby. The maker of all things shrank down to become an ovum. A single fertilized egg, barely visible to the naked eye. An egg that would divide and redivide until a fetus took shape, enlarging cell by cell inside a nervous 13-year-old girl. This is one of the most amazing things in history. God inside a teenager for 9 months. Born in a barn or a cave, to peasants, he ruled from an animal's feeding trough. There's a pop song some of you are old enough to remember that made the charts years ago. It asked what the difference it would make if God were just a slob like one of us. And some found those words and that song sacrilegious, but that's exactly the reaction of his family and his neighbors and his countrymen. How could God be a slob like one of us? And we always sing, God is great, how great thou art, awesome God, and all that, and that's rightfully so. But Christmas tells us God became little. God who could not control his bladder. God who depended on a junior high girl for shelter and love and food. God with diaper rash. God who spits up. Did God have a crush on a girl when he was 14? A God who perhaps texted during it to synagogue service. He was human, just like us. And it's almost blasphemy to think that. To the Jews, it would be. Now, to the pagans, same thing. Before Jesus, almost no pagan author thought humility was a compliment. To be humble was an insult and demeaning. So to them, a humble God was an oxymoron, kind of like government intelligence or government organization or government work. Well, I won't go there. Or Trump diplomacy, you know, things like that. Anyway, when God visits earth, he becomes humble. And he comes in the most humble way possible. That's why so many had a hard time recognizing Jesus as God. And I got to thinking, how different was God's visit compared to presidential visits today? I looked it up. Air Force One cost over $228,000 per hour to fly. President Obama sometimes travels with a 900-person, 45-car, two Air Force Ones, three cargo plane entourage. The 13-hour visit he took to South Africa for Mandela's funeral in 2013 cost an estimated $11 million, not including the flight. They used 127 hotel rooms. And now we learn that Air Force One costs $4 billion to make. Now, God is bigger than the president. In fact, the equivalent to the president back then would be Caesar Augustus. How much do we know about Caesar Augustus today? Most people wouldn't know much. And it's going to be the same way with any president today. In a couple thousand years, not many's going to know much about these presidents. God is bigger than any president, and his visit took place in an animal shelter where a mule could have stepped on him. I mean, it could not be more humble. And that makes him an approachable gift. Few of us appreciate the change that Jesus brought in how human beings approach deity. Today, Muslims bow down so low that their foreheads touch the ground to stress the immeasurable greatness of Allah. In the Old Testament, we have the burning bush of Moses and the hot coals of Isaiah and the extraterrestrial visions of Ezekiel. Any person who encountered God expected to come away scorched or glowing or maybe half crippled like Jacob or even dead. You touch God's mountain, you die. You touch the Ark of the Covenant, you die. You enter the most holy place, you will not come out alive. God had a walled-off, separate sanctum, and you don't dare come near. And now, he's in a manger. What can be less scary than a newborn? In Jesus, God found a way of relating to human beings that did not involve fear and distance. And the reason he did that is fear and distance did not work out very well. The Old Testament didn't work. A new approach was needed, a new covenant. The Old Testament emphasized the gulf between God and humanity, and it looks forward to that gulf being bridged. And in Jesus, the gulf has finally been ultimately removed. So he's an approachable gift. But because he's God, he is, of course, an eternal gift. Any gift you receive this year will not last. It will end up in the junk pile someday. Only God's gift is everlasting, and my wish for you is that you will see this Christmas is so much bigger and richer and deeper than any gift or tree or music or family. It is so much more than any of that. Unfortunately, December is not always a happy time. Suicides rise, depression rises, tempers flare. You stop at an intersection and some fellow falls out in front of you. You do the impatient thing and honk at him. He looks at you and makes a gesture with his finger. And being the man or woman of God that you are, you're not sure what it means, but you are certain that it does not mean Merry Christmas. And what your Christmas will be like this year will depend somewhat on the focus of your celebration. And if you decide that the one with the most toys, if I just get that one toy, I win, you're in for a big disappointment. If it's all about music, family, food, there'll be some temporary joy, but it'll leave you empty. Jesus changes perspective from temporary to eternal, a lasting gift that can never be taken away. I came across this poem. This was the day after Christmas, and all through the town, the ones who weren't Christians were feeling let down. The stockings weren't hung by the chimney anymore, and boxes and wrappings covered the floor. The chicken was covered from floor to ceiling with enough dirty dishes to set Mother reeling. The children were whining over what they didn't get, and rather than sharing, they were throwing a fit. The malls were bustling with post-Christmas shoppers, searching for bargains on racks and in hoppers. The salesmen looked haggard, the shoppers looked worse, as credit cards flew out of wallets and purse. There were no joyful sounds of carolers singing, and the only bells heard were registers ringing. The scene was altogether too grim for all the people who didn't know him. If only this unhappy crowd could know that the spirit of Christmas isn't tied with a bow and stacked in piles underneath the tree, it lives forever in you and me. It didn't start in presents piled in a sleigh. It started with Christ being born that day. The perfect gift from our Father above, sent to us sinners to show his love. He came without wrapping or boxes or strings, no glitter or glamour or other earthly things. He came with a promise of hope for all men, that even in death, we'd have life again. I don't know why, but for some reason, this year it has just hit me more so than other years that Christmas without Christ is really shallow. I mean, what's left? Santa Claus? You kind of get the feeling Santa Claus is taking the place of Jesus in our culture. Really? Nothing against Santa. But if that's it, yuck. And I don't want to be the Scrooge today, so go ahead and enjoy your gifts. God's a giver, and he wants us to give. Enjoy the food. God made food for us to enjoy. Enjoy your family. God made your family. You can enjoy them. But it is so much more, so much richer and deeper and better. Have a real Christmas this year. Listen to what Paul says about this indescribable gift in Colossians 1. And I want you to listen and look at this. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. Notice the word all. For in him all things were created. Things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He's before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything or all things he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. That's what Christmas is about. The eternal gift. But perhaps even more amazing, it's an unconditional gift. Much giving at Christmas time, you know, is out of obligation. Well, I better give them something because they'll probably get me something and I need to reciprocate. Or if I don't give, they'll be offended, and I don't want to make my boss mad, and I don't want to offend my mother-in-law. And no longer is giving an act of grace, it's become an act of duty. But this first gift, undeserved, unconditional, no strings attached, God gave it, knowing full well people would not reciprocate, a number of people would not, and would even reject it. He did not set up a gift exchange, although that's what he hoped for. He gives us his life, and we give our lives back to him. But even still, if we don't reciprocate, he gives it unconditional, undeserved. I read a story about a whiskey bottle that was put in the Thames River of old London town in 1937. Had a cork in it, floated down the Thames River, moved away from the east coast of England, headed northbound past the Netherlands, moved through the North Sea past the coast of Norway, traveling within 400 miles of the Arctic Circle. It ended up in the icy Bering Sea, hundreds of miles north of the Soviet Union. The currents eventually moved the bottle eastward over Siberia through the Laptev Sea and then through the East Siberian Sea. The bottle remained intact and airtight for 12 years. It floated into the Bering Strait between Siberia and Alaska, then past the Aleutian Islands, then into the North Pacific, then along the west coast of the United States, and then at last, its voyage of almost 12 years and some 12,000 miles came to an end. And a chilly day, March 16, 1949, a fellow named Jack Wurm, W-U-R-M, was wandering a deserted San Francisco beach and happened upon that bottle half buried in the sand. You've heard this story or seen things like it. Jack was 55 years old, jobless, near penniless, and despondent. His restaurant business was bankrupt. His life savings gone. Jack discovered this bottle, saw something in it, broke the bottle on a rock, and recovered the vessel's contents, a piece of paper, upon which was handwritten this message: "To avoid all confusion, I leave my entire estate to the lucky person who finds this bottle and to my attorney, Barry Cohen, share and share alike, signed Daisy Alexander, June 20th, 1937. And yes, it stood up in court. Daisy Alexander was an eccentric heiress to a large portion of the Singer sewing machine fortune. And Jack Wurm found a whiskey bottle that had begun its journey half a world away. In 1949, he received $6 million worth about $59 million today. Jack was lucky. But we are more lucky. An undeserved, unconditional, free gift. of God himself. Jack's gift was big, but temporary. God's gift is so much bigger and eternal. But there's another thing we need to know, we have to know about this gift. It is exclusive. There is no other name under heaven by which we must be saved. Only by Jesus can people come to God. And I know that's not politically correct. I know that's intolerant and bigoted. Who are you to say that there's only one way to God? I'm not saying it. Jesus said it. And it's fascinating to me, people hate intolerance, but they think Jesus is okay. I would suggest then they do not know Jesus or what he said. Because he was the most exclusive, intolerant man on earth. He said, I am the way and the truth and the life, and no one comes to the Father but by me. Now, I did a Greek deep study on that word no one, and it means no one. Now, either Jesus is an arrogant lunatic or it's the truth. Don't tell me he's a good man. No, he was either God or he was not. He claimed to be God. He claimed to be the only hope exclusively. And we all have to make a decision about that. He said, he who is not for me is against me. I should have added one more point to this. It's a dangerous gift. It's wonderful, it's gracious, it's undeserved, but not to be taken lightly. And I think that's the danger in the American church today, of taking this gift so lightly. I was in a Sunday school class 2 weeks ago, and then again today, taught by Tad Blacketer, talking about the Advent. Now, Advent is a historical church practice about preparing for the coming of the Lord at Christmas. Many of you come out of churches where they celebrate Advent. Technically, Advent began 2 Sundays ago. And when you read the birth accounts, you can see that the Messiah's coming was announced centuries before in the Old Testament, and that Jesus' arrival was eagerly anticipated in the first century. The entire storyline of the Bible builds to the climax of the Messiah's birth, and so anticipation and preparation really was a part of the first Christmas as well. So we're all getting ready for Christmas. The presents, the food, the decorating, cleaning the house, getting ready. But how about preparation for the real reason for Christmas? That's what Advent's about. Henry J.M. Nouwen said, once I am truly convinced that preparing the heart is more important than preparing the Christmas tree, I'll be a lot less frustrated at the end of the day. So I want to encourage you to have your own little Advent. We have 15 days until Christmas, if we count today. So obviously attend worship, Sunday school, and I want to encourage you to do a daily devotional reading time, if you don't already. I got online and found the Advent scriptures for this year, and the intention of these is for 4 of them to be read each Sunday. So I took most of them and listed them for you to read each day up until Christmas. If we can get those up on the screen. There we go. There's the scriptures there. And I have made copies printed out at the tables for you. You can pick one up this morning. And I just want to encourage you to read one a day. They're not very long, just to prepare our hearts and our minds and our souls, not just preparing trees and food. Let's make Christmas a little richer and a little deeper. Now, some of these texts you'll find are not familiar Christmas texts. Some of them will be brand new to some of you. So when you read them, you need to ask, why are these chosen to prepare for the coming of Jesus? And remember, they're meant to be read 4 each Sunday, but you do one a day. And just spend some time thinking about these, spending a little time with God, talking to him, a little time with the best gift. Again, most of these are fairly short. You could do them with your children. Or maybe you want to do something else, get a children's Christmas book and go over that with them. I just want you to have a Christmas with the best gift of all. Let's pray. Lord, how can we fathom the depth and breadth of this gift? We are 2 weeks away from Christmas Day, and our prayer is that this season will be so much more than tinsel and toys. God, thank you for this indescribable gift, is what Paul calls it, for this best gift that gives us hope, joy, salvation, and so much more. And everything we do today, and we pray this prayer in Jesus' name.